control data flow diagrams for these, the important parts to note are the gates. So for LSTM, for example, you have four gates, the forget, the input, the candidate, and the output. And so what these gates do in a recurrent neural network cell is going to be controlling what information is preserved from the previous state, what information from the input should be added to that, and then what information should actually be outputted from this state. GRU, of course, is a more modern implementation that is derived from LSTM. Its primary benefit is it eliminates one of those gates, but it introduces a dependent matrix multiplication, which is an important optimization point that we'll talk about later in the talk. And so why is this important? And this is important because all of us are using RNNs almost every day. When we make a search on, for example, Google or Bing or any search engine, typically that goes through a pipeline of a number of recurrent neural network models, each of which may spawn a number of document queries, as many as 65 batches for a single input. And we all want those queries to happen very quickly. When I search, I don't want to wait 10 to 15 seconds to get my answer. And these days, we have much higher expectations for how those should behave. If I ask a question in a search engine, it's very helpful for it to highlight that answer for me. So in this case, who is the actress who plays Chloe's mom on Lucifer? It's able to parse the results that it's already generated as top candidates, find a paragraph that includes the answer, and actually highlight that text in the answer. And so again, that's going to be going through a process of multiple RNNs along the way. And so these strict SLAs are very difficult when it comes to serving these models. When you have maybe only a few milliseconds to serve a multi-layer RNN, you end up with a case that you can't batch them as effectively as you otherwise would. So batching tends to mean you're taking multiple input sequences and processing them in the same time step. And so this allows us to typically move from vector matrix out linear algebra to matrix linear algebra, which is going to be much easier for us to achieve high throughput with. However, that isn't really an option when we have SLAs that are this low. So some prior understanding when it comes to RNN inference optimization, Deep CPU in 2018 introduced the concept of computing time-independent and time-dependent states separately. So you process the entire input sequence, process that through the gates through one large batch matrix multiplication, and then you individually process all of the sequential dependencies with a slightly smaller cell, but this reduces your cache thrashing quite a bit and reduces how many weights you need to stream in on each time step. BatchMaker, which was actually presented here last year, attempts to increase batching by doing it at a more granular level rather than batching only when you get new inputs that come in. We're going to take advantage of that cellular granularity and join them at the cell. And then there's also, of course, your typical neural network model transformations, quantization down to fixed point or FP16, as well as structured sparsity techniques that reduce the dimensionality of the model. But fundamentally, all of these are still going to be limited, especially for the GPU, on how quickly you can actually process a single cell. And if you can't process that cell fast enough to serve that model or to meet that SLA, it's very difficult for a business to provide the services that they'd like to do. So we're going to take a quick look at the GPU architecture, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that are important. So your GPU is divided into a number of streaming multiprocessors. Each streaming multiprocessor has a scheduling slice that consists of some ALUs, a scheduler, and then the register file. And so the register file on a GPU is much, much larger than what you're looking at on a CPU. So each streaming multiprocessor in this case is 256 kilobytes. And this presents a really great opportunity because this is obviously, registers are going to be very fast, and this is a lot of memory we can use to maybe persist weights. Our L1 cache is typically allocated primarily as programmer addressable shared memory. It has access latencies of about 20 cycles, which if we compare to something like CPU where the L1 access time is 4 cycles, or even the L2 or L3 on CPUs being faster than that in most cases, we can see that this memory hierarchy is very slow. And so when we're looking at a patch like this where we're looking with small hidden sizes or small batch sizes where we don't have as much data level parallelism, this memory architecture being as slow as it is from a latency perspective can be very limiting. So some key terminology we're going to be using, kernel is going to be a GPU program. We use the CUDA programming language for this, so that is a single instruction, multiple threads programming paradigm. When a kernel is written, it's written such that you assume that you have some sort of thread block, which is a cooperative thread array. And that's just a group of threads that are logically organized and scheduled together onto the GPU. So everything in a CTA will be on the same streaming multiprocessor. And then a launch is just going to be the instantiation of a kernel with an associated grid of thread blocks to actually complete a task. So existing libraries for high-performance RNN inference on GPU include something like Cuden's traditional algorithm. And so this uses a highly optimized gem kernel for its gates, and it follows that with an element-wise kernel that has been optimized as well. This is used by the TensorRT runtime, if you're familiar with that, which is NVIDIA's front-end for neural network inference. And the big issue that we have with this is you have some really high kernel launch overhead when you're launching a kernel for every single time step. So looking at this data here, so this is a synthetic benchmark across multiple batch sizes with sequence length 100. And we can see that despite the fact that the model with 16 times more computation, the hidden size 256, the latency characteristics are almost the exact same as the hidden size 64. And so that suggests that that kernel launch overhead is something that you need to avoid when you're writing a high-performance RNN engine. The other issue you're having is you're repeatedly loading your data for all of these. So for this large model here, hidden size 1024, we're loading that full matrix, the weight matrix, on every iteration. And so the throughput there that we're achieving is on the order of only about 10% of the GPU, which is, again, not very efficient. If I'm looking to equip a data center, I don't want to have 10,000 GPUs only getting 10% of their utilization. That's not a cost-effective. So the alternative to that is Cuden's persistent algorithm. And so this is going to use a single kernel rather than one or two for each time step. And it's going to loop over the entire input sequence. And so this does extremely well for low batch sizes, which is great, because that allows us to maybe serve models that we otherwise could not. But its scalability is incredibly poor when we're looking at increasing our batch size. When we've increased our batch size by 20 in these cases, we're maybe only getting a 50% throughput improvement. And in our best case is maybe getting 20% at best of our GPU. So again, this is still a fairly ineffective solution to our problem. So our key question is, can a GPU-based inference library really achieve low latency, high throughput, and efficient hardware utilization to make it a viable option for serving these sorts of models? So like I had said when talking about the Cuden traditional algorithm, a non-persistent approach is very expensive because you're loading those weights on each iteration. We're bringing them in, we have to have that kernel launch between, and we're hitting that main memory hierarchy really, really frequently. And again, we're looking at hundreds of cycles for each access to that main memory pool. So we're going to work from the idea of an ideal persistent approach. So we're going to take that idea from deep CPU. We're going to have a time-independent gem using only our input weights. And then we'll launch a single persistent kernel that streams the hidden weights at the beginning of its instantiation and then continues to process the inputs and outputs before terminating at the end of the sequence. So gRNN is going to use the following flow for its execution. You're going to start by replicating the hidden state from global memory, or in this case, typically L2 cache, since the state tends to be relatively small. You're going to map work groups to the hidden state, and the work group is a group of threads that is going to be used to accomplish one singular task within a subtile, and I'll go into more detail about how that works. We're going to perform our core computation, so this will be the dot products and the reductions that you need to complete your gate multiplications, as well as those element-wise operations that we abstracted away in the dependency graph. And then we're going to merge those local outputs back into global memory so we can repeat the process. So one of the first challenges we encounter is that a naive persistent kernel is going to introduce too many synchronizations. So we have to synchronize every time we perform any sort of communication between two streaming multiprocessors. And so here we have a hypothetical GPU with four streaming multiprocessors and two cells, a cell with two gates. And so if we were to assign the first weight matrix to SM0 and 1 and the second matrix to SM2 and 3, we're going to have to synchronize before we do our element-wise operations and after we do them. And so again, we have to go out to L2 cache access for our synchronization because that is the only part that's going to be globally visible by all of our threads, and this is going to make for very slow synchronization. So our solution to that is output-driven tiling. We tile the columns of our weight matrices such that the weights needed to produce a single output element are always co-located on the same streaming multiprocessor. So in this case, we'll have slices of each of those matrices located on the same SM such that we can produce that output and immediately begin our element-wise operations. And so here we have an output tile that is a batch size 2 and a hidden size over 2. And this allows us to flexibly tile that depending on the needs of our batch at that time. So this is an equivalent system that is going to be doing a slightly different tiling, but it still only requires a single synchronization. And so there are some trade-offs involved in here. By tiling narrower, you can reduce your intra-SM communication at the cost of weight duplication, and that's something we'll explore in our performance model. But this does bring up the case of GRU, which does have dependent matrix multiplications. So we can synchronize between gates and effectively treat this as two separate cells that have to be run every time we have an input sequence. But that's still very expensive, especially for smaller models where you might spend almost all of your time actually in synchronization rather than computation. So our solution for this is race ahead. And what that does is it assumes that at the end of a gate computation, you have some slice of your next hidden state. So if you imagine a typical matrix multiplication with your MNK loops, typically we tile in either the M or the N dimension. But if we tile in the K dimension, we can produce partial sums that we can then share without the additional overhead of having to replicate those weights across all of our streaming multiprocessors. And so in doing so, we can sort of race ahead to our next time step, or race ahead to the next gate, perform most of the computation without any additional weight overhead, share some extra data, and perform some redundant computation. And in doing so, we can eliminate one of those synchronizations, which, as we said, is typically going to be much more expensive than the computation that we're going to be doing redundantly. And so again, that's our big trade-off, is the synchronization more versus that increased data movement and redundant computation. And that also is something that we'll talk about with our performance model. So we want to also balance our resource usage on the SM. So we have some subtile that's been assigned to it, and we're going to use these work groups. So again, a work group is going to be maybe 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 threads that is going to cooperatively produce some part of that subtile. So one strategy that we tried was one work group for one output element. And so this is very simple from an implementation standpoint, and it means that only each work group only has to perform one reduction. The concern here is that accessing from L1 or shared memory, we're only getting one use of each element accessed there, and again, with 20 cycles, that ends up with a lot of idle time. So continuing along this strategy, let's try the opposite extreme. We use a maximum size work group, so up to 32 threads, to process large subtiles. So in this example on the lower right, that would be all four of those is going to be considered one subtile. And so we can reuse a hidden state value as wide as the tile output is. And that really increases our ALU utilization effectively. But now we're performing multiple wider reductions, which is going to be counteracting that benefit. So we're again going to go for a fully flexible approach where we have a wide number of choices for how large our work group can be, and we can assign them with an arbitrary tile. And so that allows us to adapt to a wide range of serving configurations. If our batch size is small, we can use large work groups to improve occupancy, a large hidden size. We can distribute the weights across multiple threads so that we don't have to push them onto the stack, into local memory, into the memory hierarchy. And we can use smaller work groups to mitigate the cost of reductions on large number of outputs. So as you can see, we've adopted very flexible strategies for each of these, but that leaves us with a really large optimization space. And with the way CUDA's developed to allow for loop unrolling and things like that, you have to provide those values at compile time. So if you have tens of thousands of configurations, you have to compile tens of thousands of kernels and benchmark each of them in order to determine which one is going to be best for a single batch size configuration, which is extremely expensive. And each of these configurations, even though they may look similar, can provide very different performance characteristics, as shown in the table. So we developed a performance model that is going to predict the relative performance of configurations for a given model. It's going to be calculating a marginal cost loosely based off the cost of an FMA And it's actually fairly portable between cell designs. So if you developed a new cell, the performance model would be able to adapt to it pretty easily. So one major component of this is the communication costs. And so this is going to be derived from how much data movement you're going to have between the streaming multiprocessors, how much bus interference you're going to have. And that's going to be analytical, just based off of the hardware characteristics. Synchronization is going to be measurement-based model. The measurements for that are fairly stable across a configuration, pretty much how much does it cost to perform that extra synchronization in the case of GRU. Computation costs, we used a micro benchmark, and so this micro benchmark needs to be run once per GPU you're compiling for, and it can then be used for any either LSTM, GRU, any hidden size, any batching size. And so the reason why we chose this versus an analytical or maybe some other heuristic is simply because with an in-order machine like this, you're heavily dependent on the order these instructions are going to be emitted by the compiler. And this was not able to be analytically modeled in that way, but the micro benchmark captured the main points of contention that we needed to see. So to select some configuration, you need to prune the optimization space, and we do that with some relatively simple techniques that look at how much occupancy you'll have. Are you unbalancing your streaming multiprocessor in some way? You calculate your cost metric for the remaining configurations you have. You select your top K configurations for benchmarking. And then based on those benchmark results of your top K, return the highest performing select configuration. So for our experimental settings, we ran both synthetic and real world models. For our synthetic models, we're looking at a sequence length of 100. And these were run on an NVIDIA Titan V, which is relatively similar to a V100. So from a latency standpoint, we are up to 17 times faster than state-of-the-art on CPU, and up to 7.4 times faster than NVIDIA's implementations for LSTM. And so this actually holds fairly nicely across all configurations. We don't have any case where we show any sort of performance degradation against CUDA or deep CPU. And so what's important to note here is comparing against CPU, we're actually utilizing our hardware more efficiently. Previous literature has suggested that CPUs are actually a better fit for this sort of algorithm, that the small task size and relatively branchiness of an LSTM or a GRU cell made them a poor fit. But by utilizing the register file in this way and adapting our tiles to the problem, we actually get better utilization. Race ahead GRU is actually going to reduce latency up to 35%. So in this case, across 6 of the 9 configurations, it is better to redundantly share that information and do additional computation versus the cost of that synchronization. And our performance model is very effective at navigating that large search space. Compared to brute forcing the entire search space and actually getting a configuration, you're typically only increasing your latency by about 3%, in worst cases, about 10%. On real-world models, as you can see, we provide the best of both worlds from a both latency and scalability standpoint, whereas CUDA and Persistent used to provide the best latency at those small batch sizes. We're able to compete with them at that point. But we provide that same sort of scalability as you add additional inputs that you would see from something like CUDA traditional. So to summarize, we have state-of-the-art performance for RNN inference on GPU. We use output-based tiling to minimize our synchronization costs. Flexible tiling allows us to adapt to a wide range of model configurations, and the performance model effectively prunes the optimization space such that we can do this much more efficiently than brute forcing or otherwise. Thank you, and any questions? Yeah. So it's going to be that level of the L2 cache. So the L2 cache is about 200 cycles on its own. So to get it to another compute element, you've got to read 200 cycles, go back to another one, read another 200 cycles. And typically, you're spinning on these things, so there's overhead associated with that. You could start doing skip ahead versus doing multiple cells and redundantly storing some weights. So it's possible to do it that way, but you're pretty close to the fundamental limits of what the hardware can do.
More questions? I have a question.
Yes.
So a lot of this is optimizing on the cell, but what if you have 5 different cells? What if you have 10 different cells, different matrices? If you have a 3RNN or something like that, or a GNN, does that change at all, given that you have more data to shuffle in?
So if you have a stacked layers, so typically your serving configuration for that is you're going to process those layers sequentially anyways. And so an optimization like this actually adapts to that quite well. Those real-world models here were actually stacked models. If you have a new cell design, currently, of course, you'd have to re-implement the basic ideas for it. But the fundamental ideas of persistence are still portable to that, as well as the idea of the performance model.
Last chance. OK, do some clapping. Thank you.